yeah, I think evolution just in itself is an emergent property that we're describing. So
yeah,
it's just multiple different interactions that we're trying to explain, and we can never really, we can only ever grasp it at a higher level, and that's it.
It's a kind of search process which mm-hmm. accumulates information.
Yeah.
And unlike almost every other search process that we've created in computers, mm-hmm. it never converges. It's just still diverging, just continuously accumulating information.
And it's an agent. Isn't it? Well, simply that they've become more and more complex with time, right? And intelligence has existed from the get-go. As soon as a single agent exists, intelligence exists. And so the evolution of it is simply a byproduct of multiple agents then existing and multiple different types of agents existing.
I don't want to say that you are an agency chauvinist, but you were just saying that there might be one particular way of demonstrating agency. And earlier on, you were saying, Well, we should look at the overall system, and there is a distribution of agency. It has loci all over the system. And you could draw a big boundary and say, well, that thing's has agency. But you could be much more efficient, and you could draw a smaller boundary, and that smaller boundary would have almost all of the agency of the big boundary, because most of the things in the big boundary are just mimicking or stealing agency from things in the small boundary. So Keith, you were saying it's really important for us to encapsulate the most agency possible, which is to say the most amount of temporal planning in the smallest space.
Imagine I'm a pilot steering a ship. Okay, and if somebody looking from the outside looked at the ship, they may decide that the ship as a whole is an agent. You know, it's planning. Like, obviously it's planning. It navigated through, you know, the Suez Canal and some locks and whatever else. But there's a smaller subsystem. If we had the ability to analyze this, we could find a smaller subsystem, which is the pilot, you know, this human being who's sitting at the controls, who's actually the agent, right? And maybe you could shrink it down a bit further and say it's really just all his brain. It's everything inside of his skull that's kind of doing the planning. But then we realize that agency actually has the two sides of the coin. Like, it has the planning side of the coin, which is only happening up in here, but the inaction side is perhaps different, because if you're looking at all the machinery necessary to enact the plan, it's the pilot's brain and the pilot's body and the ship itself and all its components. So I think you can come up with a different boundary if you look at the inactive piece of agency versus the planning piece of agency. But I think you do need to, on the planning side, you need to at least shrink it down to that minimal system that contains the actual planning.
And the free energy principle at its core is all about things. And at some point, things become agents. Agency isn't necessarily encapsulated within the locus of a particular thing. It's distributed throughout the dynamics of many things in the system.
I have a very simple view of this, which situates quantum, statistical, and classical or conservative mechanics simply in relation to scale. Mm. So at the very small level, everything is stochastic chaos. It can only have a description in terms of probability distributions, where things are just happening so quickly. You're in a Heinz-Bergen sense, you can't sort of tie down what's actually going on. And as you move to very, very big things, massive bodies, you get asteroids, you know, the motion of the heavenly planets that have a Lagrangian mechanics, that have a classical mechanics. In between, I think you have things like us.
Mm.
You know, we're not quantum, but nor are we just massive bodies. And what does that mean? Well, it's a beautiful mixture of conservative and dissipative dynamics in the sense of things like the Helmholtz decomposition. That mixture, I think, gives you exactly the kind of stochastic chaos you need to have this, to have the complexity and the read as, say, for example, long-range correlations over time, for example, a deep memory of what's going on. But also that itinerancy that you get with sort of agency and biotic self-organization.
Because, you know, we've spoken about systems having goals, as if goals, but it's actually kind of diffused in the dynamics of the system. And I think it might be a similar thing with agency, that we think of the agents as having this effective depth of counterfactual planning. So they're planning many, many steps into the future, many different trajectories.
If you want to articulate it in a way that somebody dealing with either deterministic or chaotic, stochastic chaotic systems, and I think what you're describing is exactly the generalized synchronization of chaos that characterizes biotic self-organization, that will entail the kind of agency, or will be necessary to manifest or evince the kind of agency we're talking about, which is this future pointing aspect of movement.
Yes.
What you're describing would, I think, be read as somebody in the maths of random dynamical systems, perhaps, as generalized synchronization or synchronization of chaos. If you're a statistician, that's just saying that in virtue of there being a synchronization manifold between, agent A and agent B, or me and the rest of the world, my eco niche, then there is just because there is this synchronization manifold in our joint space, then there has to be a high mutual information. And just if you were free energy principle theorist, you would say, yes, of course, because the expected free energy just is a constrained mutual information. So if you write down the expression for the free energy functional, the expected free energy functional underwrites the paths that we take. It is just the mutual information plus constraints, and those constraints are the goals. They're just a description of the characteristic states that shape that synchronization manifold. So all of those things, the resonance that you mentioned, the mm-hmm. distributed aspect, are all, I think, foundational and quintessential reflections of something that has got a pullback attractor. If you're talking to Chris Fields, or you're doing this from the point of view of quantum information theory, what you've just said is the principle of unitarity. That ultimately, when you converge on your attracting set, everything is coupled, and when everything is synchronized, everything now becomes, if you like, is effectively conditionally dependent, that there is this mutual information. And of course, that's one way of just saying that, or one way of looking at the license for people like me to say what's happening on the inside somehow represents what's going on the outside. It's just another way of interpreting or placing a teleology on that kind of...
Yeah, so could we look at a dynamical system and point to a locus of agency?
Well, I guess, so I want to say two things, because this came up with Wolfram too, which is I don't agree with the conflation of agency with non-determinism. Like in my worldview, in fact, I don't even necessarily agree, Carl, that at the deepest level of the universe, I don't think you have to have actually stochastic or true random processes. I think you can just have like such highly nonlinear chaotic systems that even though they're totally deterministic, they're for all intents and purposes not predictable, whatsoever. And so therefore you can just model them as, stochastic. And so I think you could have a universe that was super deterministic, just deterministic at every conceivable level, and yet I would still identify agents. I would say that I'm an agent, even if I'm completely deterministic, right? So I guess that's the first thing I think of. And the second thing is, sure, you may be able to have multiple ways, Tim, of identifying a locus, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all ways are extant in any particular organism. So even though in my brain it may have been possible that I could identify my agency with, a whole variety of combinations of neurons in the kind of Putnam sense, like it's only one of them that actually is the manifestation of that. And I think the reason why that's the case is the same reason why Putnam's rock like falls apart. It's like, yeah, you may be able to map a conscious process to a particular history of the rock, but the very next time step, the rock will deviate from that. It's not going to continue along the same trajectory that the conscious brain would have.
Language has this mimetic quality. We all speak different languages. You speak a certainly a significantly more advanced form of language than I do, Carl. But so language is a bit like an organism. It's alive. It's parasitic on humans. There's an asymmetry in velocity. Weirdly, our culture and language evolves very quickly. Our DNA evolves very slowly. And if you killed all humans, the language would die. Yeah. Kill a few humans, the language lives on. And not only that, I, from a cognitive science point of view, I believe that even things like syllogisms, you can argue which things are Platonic, which things are cultural. But the way that we think, all of those tools and programs are embedded in our culture, which is largely our language. Yeah. So then it raises the question, well, if we have this agency, experience, consciousness, planning, call it what you want, reasoning, which emerges from all these little things in our brain and even our sense world, could it be argued that language itself has a form of agency? So when I say, Carl, it's my goal to do XYZ. I want to get another PhD. And maybe the super organism has entirely different designs on what it wants to do. And I'm deluding myself that I have any free will at all. I mean, do you think in principle language could be, you know, language as a super organism could be self-aware?
No.
No. Why not?
So if you're saying that the super organism is just drawing a Markov blanket around a particular culture or you know, society or population or ensemble or not set of conspecifics. I think you made a very clear point before that you know, you cannot get a joint free energy minima just by looking at one kind of species. You know, it has to be an ecosystem that necessarily has all sorts, even at one given scale, all sorts of different kinds of phenotypes within it, things to eat, things that do the eating, things that do the breathing and the things that you breathe. That scale-free perspective, and particularly the separation of temporal scales and scales that distinguish between an individual and the population or the ensemble in which that individual finds herself, is absolutely fundamental. And that certainly could be attributed sort of mental states of a minimal or basic sentience sort. But I don't think that they plan.
We're transgressing from the material world into the information world. And that's not necessarily a problem because the free energy principle does that anyway. I think the more interesting distinction is that we are transgressing from an agentive world to a non-agentive world. So
yes,
if we
yes.
think of language as being, it's very similar to Dawkins' selfish gene.
Yeah.
He had this beautiful idea that you know, genes, in a sense, they live in this, almost in a different substrate.
Yes.
They don't care about what you do.
Yes.
And could language be the same? What?
Yes. So, oh, yeah, yeah.
But then could you in any way conceptualize this super language structure as having agency or agents?
No.
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 Why not?
Because I am, when you say agent, I hear something that plans. So if you're saying, does natural selection plan? No. Does the weather plan? No. Is there a kind of basic sentience and information gathering in the weather and natural selection? Absolutely. There's masses of self-evidencing and autopoiesis at various scales. So it's when you say agent, I read that as a very particular kind of system beyond just having active states. It has to be able to plan. So language can be used for planning, and it can certainly... and indeed, you know, literally, in the it's actually under review in neuroscience and behavioral reviews as we speak. It is simple to show that language is an emergent property when you put lots of free energy minimizing things together. So you can joint free energy minimum is just that in which a common ground and a common language emerges. It's trivial. It's just maximize mutual predictability. Maximizing mutual predictability minimizes joint surprise. Joint surprise is basically one way of reading free energy. And it's a negative of the self-evidence that we're talking about before. So language is an emergent property and certainly as such, will look as if it is a facilitator of self-evidencing and intelligent processing. But in and of itself, it does not plan.
But this is one of those as if questions again. I mean, for example, we had the all of the horrible violence going on at the moment, but there are lots of memes circulating on Twitter, mm-hmm. and the memes adapt. And if you look at the memes as being a kind of agent in a way, you could almost see, you could view them as, you know, as if they were planning or had agency.
I see. Well, okay. Well, perhaps I'm being too specific in my interpretation of agent. I mean, if you interpret agent as something that has active states, that that, you know, you can draw a boundary around it.
Yes.
You know, from my perspective, a Markov blanket, or if you don't like that, then you input and output ports.
Hmm.
So if something has an output port or it has active states in terms of a sort of a particular partition under a Markov blanket, if that is an agent, I think yes, you could certainly say that anything that you can draw a line around, you could individuate from something else, including language, yes. any meme. You know, I don't want to sort of generalize the selfish gene too much, but you know, anything that survives and endures then inherits all the properties of all the as-if properties afforded by the free energy principle. And if it has active states, then it has that kind of agency. So perhaps we can reconcile any. You really want to say language is you know, has a kind of basic sentience. If you want to say that, then I would have to say yes. If agents are just defined by influencing states beyond their, you know, beyond the thing that they are. I repeat, for me though, agency implies not just that you act upon the world like a thermostat or like the weather or by like natural selection. Hmm. It actually means that you you have you're implicitly a generative model of the future. And you just come back to your mimicry argument. There is a way of telling the difference. So as a site, you'll never know. But there is a way of telling the difference between a mimic and a planner.
Yeah.
And that's the fact that the mimic will have a state action policy, which means that, yes, there is something that is learnable, but all that can be learned is a mapping from being in a particular state to being a particular action. Mm. So this, of course, is the holy grail of Q-learning and you know, all the deep learning that we've seen nowadays under the hood in terms of, indeed, large language models. That is not the same as planning, because once you have planning in play, then you can work out what I will believe. Well, what if I do that? And of course, what I will believe if I do that depends upon what I believe now. It's not a function of the state. It's a function of of my beliefs about the state. So there are no state action policies. So given the same state, a planning agent will do a different thing the next time around. Mm-hmm. A mimic will not. So although I said you will never know the difference between the two, there are ways of soliciting the right kind of data to distinguish between a mimic and a large language model.
Yes.
And a true agent that plans, that has that sort of prospective aspect to it, simply because it will remember and learn or inherit from its previous being in that kind of state.
How strongly do you hold on to the materialism?
Yeah, well, those two examples you gave, I thought that was quite fascinating, because one structural materialistic feature that distinguishes between particles that have generative models of the consequence that can plan is that the random variables, the latent states covered by their generative model, includes their own actions. So this is a bit subtle. There are certain kinds of things that have active states, like thermostats, and they have attracting sets, and they do good homeostasis, and possibly even do quite sort of protracted kinds of itinerant homeostasis that look very much like mimics or allostasis. But you know, at no point does their generative model cover or infer their own actions. They know what they're doing because, you know, their actuator, the heating element, directly is sensed by the internal states. But for other kinds of systems, things like you and me, we don't really know what our muscles are doing. All we can do is sense the consequences through proprioception of what's going on, which means that our actual actions are latent states. So suddenly now, from the point of view of the generative model on the inside, if it exists, then my own actions become the cause of my sensations. And that sounds very, very similar. And of course, I have to act in order to produce the sensations to make the inference I'm doing this. So you get this sort of exactly as you're describing. I have to wait. The virtual machine has to wait until the physical machine tells me what I did. So you know, there's a temporality which is inherent in that kind of structure.
I suppose you're describing a kind of message passing process,
yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
And no reason, I don't think, in principle, why the message couldn't traverse the material, non-material boundary and then come back again.
Yes.
And in principle, be diffused to many, many underlying agents.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful.
Hello, everyone. It's Tim here from MLST, your go-to channel and podcast for all things machine learning, AI, and philosophy. Creating content for MLST takes a considerable amount of time and resources. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. Every bit helps, although please only donate what is an insignificant amount of money, depending on your situation. Anyway, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to welcome you to our Patreon family. Signing off for now. Cheers.
Rudy, it's an honor to meet you.
It is an honor to meet you, Tim.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Rudy Jane Pitlia. That's my full name. And I'm a PhD student at the moment at the University of Oxford. And I'm also being fully funded by Versus. And so I spend a lot of my time working on very exciting projects here as well.
So what are your research interests?
Mainly computationally analyzing psychological phenomena and psychopathology as well. So it's trying to just understand human behavior, human interactions at a singular level, at a multi-agent level, in a more computational way, just to understand the cognitive processes that are being engaged and kind of ground this empirically by collecting behavioral data and see whether the computations are explaining indeed what we see is happening.
Decomposing cognition into autonomous agents.
Yeah.
What does that give us?
I think that gives us a very intricate realization of the processes that are actually happening, which is we are a perception, or we are perceiving the world as a function of how we sample the world, which is how we're acting within the world, right? And so, at least in my PhD work, what we are finding is that people's perception of the degree of agency they believe they have, so the degree of control they believe they have in their environment, is simply a function of how much they're engaging with the environment. Because the more that you engage, the more relevant data you receive. We are not only engaging in perceiving the reality of the world and then acting to only optimize the utility function, so to get as much reward as possible, or exploring, so in gaining as much information as possible. It's actually a function of both, and they are very simply put together. So then there's a trade-off between the two, a balance between the two. And so I think that's where the autonomous agents come in. It's explaining that we're not really just inanimate objects perceiving the reality as we see it, but rather we move around, and it's only because of that that we see what we see.
Interesting. So yeah, as you say, like the free energy principle, it formulates in a very principled way, like this trade-off between exploration and exploitation, you know, energy and entropy. But I think there's more to it than to say exploration is what gives rise to agency. And one thing I wanted to explore, which I think is very interesting, is this notion that
an agent. It could be at the top of the stack, so it could be composed of a hierarchy of agents below it.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about an ecosystem of agents, your actions become a kind of weird composite of other agents in the system.
Yeah.
Which could arguably truncate your agency.
Well, that's only when you use the definition of agency is free will, right? I would argue against that. I'd say that it's almost, because it's explainable, it is somewhat deterministic.
Mm-hmm.
In a probabilistic manner, of course. All of this is grounded within probability theory.
I mean, maybe we could explore the free will thing just a tiny bit, because I guess like one thing that interests me is, just like there's, in my opinion, no such thing as a pure intelligence. Mm-hmm. In some sense, there's no such thing as we can do whatever we want.
Yeah.
Right. So we are situated in a physical environment.
Yeah.
We can do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So straight away that truncates our free will, because we are limited by the situation we're in.
Yeah.
We're also limited by the other agents, mm-hmm. In our environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can kind of say, okay, well, maybe it's a bit of both. So there are guardrails, there are trajectories that are takeable, but we still have some choice over those trajectories.
Yeah, exactly. So we were talking about this a little bit earlier today, about semantics of language, right?
Yes.
And like how language in itself has a form of agency, but it's only a function of its users as well. And so I think you can kind of draw a parallel over there, where all of these interactions that are happening between different agents, it is certain restrictions that you're having, but that is not what truncates your sense of agency. You still have the ability to act and the want to act, the will to act, right? The things that are explaining your actions are also limited by your own generative model. So are you sampling the world to support your generative model, to test your hypotheses? In a way, I guess it is a little bit paradoxical to say that your agency is limited or restricted by all of these different processes, but it is those processes that allow you to be an agent in the first place.
Yeah, because I was speaking to Carl about this earlier, both the outer loop of, as an agent, I seek new information, to learn about my sense world. And also this idea of language as being a super organism.
Yeah.
The reason I think that's a delicious thought experiment is we were teasing apart the extent to which Kyle is a materialist.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of virtual agents, which are, composed of a distributed set of underlying physical agents,
mm-hmm.
and their actions are as if they're not direct actions.
Yeah.
So they can't act because they're not physical, but mm-hmm. you can kind of perceive their actions, like a meme, for example. You can think of a meme as being an agent, even though it's a virtual thing.
Yeah,
and
certainly.
So in some sense, there could be even a hierarchy of virtual agents.
Yeah.
And Carl didn't like that idea very much. But what's your intuition?
I actually quite like that idea, because as soon as there is an outcome to the meme existing, for example, the virtual agent existing, there's an interaction that's occurring. That in itself is that object acting, producing an action, and it resulting in a consequence, a observation in the shared environment of the agents that are interacting with one another. And so, again, to bring back the whole like semantics of language and it developing its own identity, right? I think that's the same thing with memes. Memes wouldn't exist if we didn't exist to interpret them, right? But they exist and are passing some information to us, and that is the outcome in itself. So it has its meaning, its semantics develops over time. So it does exist temporally. It changes temporally as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd argue that it is an agent.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful idea.
Yeah.
And as we were saying earlier, because I guess with Carl, I was talking about this in terms of material non-reductionism. So Chalmers says consciousness
you know, it arises from configurations of material, mm-hmm. but it's strongly emergent, so it's not directly reducible to the material. Yeah. This is an analogy of that, which is that we have in the information substrate, we have this superorganism which is parasitic on all of the physical agents, mm-hmm. and even though you, I guess Carl was saying, because you can't interpret the superorganism as being physical agents, that kind of broke the link for him. But yeah,
I'm a little bit surprised, because as long as you can draw a Markov blanket around it,
yeah,
it then exists as an organism and or as an agent, and you can then pinpoint that. It doesn't matter if it's material or not, right?
Yeah.
So we can draw a Markov blanket around the two of us right now, but it doesn't have to be a materialistic, continuous, actual thing that exists, right? So
yeah,
I'm a little bit surprised there.
So another thing that I've always tried to ask Kyle about is I love playing around with this idea that the boundaries are observer relative.
Yeah.
So I guess, like, maybe we could make the case for, on the one hand, the boundaries exist universally, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, they are based on your perspective.
Yeah.
And I think the inactivist viewpoint is very much about, you know, my situated knowledge, my lived experience, my mm-hmm. perspective of things.
Yeah.
So where do you fall on that dichotomy?
I think it's observer relative, because you can say a hallucination in itself exists for one person, right? Mm-hmm. There is a statistical boundary over there. There is some level of an interaction over there. The hallucination in itself is an agent. It is also it's interacting with the other agent. It moves around space. It moves around time. It has its own dynamics. And so that's why it is then observer relative, which is, if I can see it and I can experience it, you perhaps don't, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist for me.
Interesting. Okay, so from a modeling perspective, then we would, I suppose that this is consistent with, if you build a distributed system, if you implement the actor pattern, it's just software engineering best practice. You would encapsulate the actors. So every actor has its own boundaries that it draws based mm-hmm. on its perception. And in that book down there by Andy Clark, mm-hmm. he says that almost everything we experience is a hallucination.
Yeah,
because and again, it's like we said, well, language conditions are generative model. Well, actually, all of our sensation mm-hmm. Conditions are generative model.
Yeah.
And what we're doing over time by minimizing surprise is creating this very high fidelity generative model of the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. But then from this boundary point of view, you know, we were saying earlier, it's a miracle that we can even communicate and understand each other, communicate with and understand.
Yeah.
Because clearly there's a lot of divergence there, because we have different experiences. And we can overcome the brittleness, God knows how, mm-hmm. but we can experience the same things. We can at least feel we understand things in the same way. We can communicate with each other.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to build distributed software systems that use active inference mm-hmm. that overcome this brittleness.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Oh gosh, how does that work? If I had the answer to that, we wouldn't be over here with a team of researchers. I wish I had the answer to that. No, we're still working on that. We're still developing it. We're trying to scale it up in a very manageable, practical manner that is still very, very principled. I think that is just, Carl does an excellent job of just keeping us grounded to make sure that everything is done in a principled manner. So then we really get the emergent properties from the propositions of the model. I'm hoping we can form some form of a digital version of intelligence as captured by our reality of mm-hmm. intelligence that exists all around us, not like non-human intelligence as well, right?
I think the way to overcome the brittleness is to build a sufficiently high resolution model, which is to say you start very low down the stack.
Yeah.
So you rely on the self-organization and emergence and so on. And clearly, well, not clearly. I mean, let's say the same thing has happened in the universe. So the universe is a big computer.
Yeah.
And this thing has, this is the existence
case of it, basically. So let's say in principle we could build this collective intelligence from the roots up, and then we're not explicitly building an intelligence, we're growing it.
Yeah.
Right. So then we need to steer it, and we need to try and make it. We need to try and bend it to our will.
But now you're being the controller, right? But if there is a system like this, an ecosystem, it would have several emergent properties that would exist on their own. What do you mean by steering it then?
Well, I mean, let's use society as an example of an emergent super intelligent system.
Yeah.
And we steer it with governance.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like herding cats, isn't it? It's very, very difficult. Yeah, yeah. So I guess, like, if we did... And we're talking about building a distributed system.
Mm-hmm.
So almost by design, you can't control. Like, all you can do is influence. You can send messages to all of the agents.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly.
They will all interpret the message with their, you know, with their model.
Yeah, exactly.
So I can, you know, on the one hand, that's very robust, but it's also quite dangerous. Because what if it doesn't do what I want it to do?
Yeah, but again, this is just a product of the agents that exist in this distributed system, right? So I think this is an argument that Mike Levin has made quite a few times of just, you don't try to grow an arm by just working from a very bottom-up level. There's a lot of top-down processes that you can just do. You can just instruct them.
This is the notion that biology uses what I call a multi-scale competency architecture, which basically means that we are not simply nested structurally in terms of cells, which comprise tissues, comprising organs, the bodies, and then ultimately societies and so on. That's obviously true on a structural level. But more interesting is the fact that each of these layers has certain problem-solving competencies. Each one solves problems in their own space. So cells are simultaneously solving problems in physiological spaces and metabolic spaces and gene expression spaces, and tissues and organs are solving those problems. But for example, during embryogenesis or regeneration, they're also solving problems in anatomical space.
Or the little cells, the proteins, that whatever that's involved, to grow an arm, and it does, right? So steering in a way of not trying to manipulate things from a bottom-up level, but a very top-down level, which is what kind of what governance does, but it exists as a function of us as agents living in this hierarchical level. I don't have to understand how my cells are acting, right? I don't have to instruct them in any particular way.
So through self-organization, you get global coherence, and systems in biology do this all the time. You can cut worms in half and they regrow back. So when you look at, let's say, culture or a very complex collective intelligence, you can't really steer. And when I say steer, I'm not saying talk to the individuals. I'm saying, like, do some kind of, you know, how can applying pressures to it to make it do the thing I want it to do and less of the thing I don't want it to do.
Okay.
That seems really difficult.
Maybe it's also just a matter of, like, resilience. The agents just practicing resilience. It may be an instruction or a pressure that would break the system, right? And so it just refuses to enter the system.
Well, let's say, you study depression, right?
Yes.
So I want to minimize rates of depression in my society.
Mm-hmm.
So what do? I make some laws. I mandate that people only work 8 hours a day. And I try and reduce the psychosocial stress and blah, blah, blah. I do a whole bunch of stuff. And there are so many problems here. So first of all, how do you measure depression? Is it like how many people are taking antidepressants? So how many people are killing themselves?
I mean, you're trying to control a population when the problem exists in an individual level, right?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, is that your interpretation? Like, do you think of depression individualistically?
Very, very individualistically. So there are a lot of individual differences simply because the processes that are engaged within it is contextualized for each and every individual.
Hmm.
And so let's say depression could exist because I experienced a certain event early on in my life and I adopted a strategy. That strategy worked during that time. And now I've learned that strategy is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
it allows me to overcome that traumatic event. And so I adopt that strategy for the rest of my life. But now I have to unlearn that, right? But it's so embedded within the system and etched into the system that unlearning it just becomes a little bit of a harder process. But that event is different for a lot of different people, right? You're perceiving it differently already. It's influencing you in your life very, very differently. Strategies that perhaps you could adopt as you interact with your world a little bit differently, or you learn about your world a little bit differently, or you might have wrong information about the world. So there's so many different things, but if you're now trying to create a very generalized perspective by saying, take a warm bath and have some candles once in a while and that will regulate your depression, do some self-care and things like that, like it's not really going down to the root or tackling the cognitive process. It's suppressing the symptom a little bit, and that's it.
Well, I think you could argue it both ways. So, I mean, traditionally on the left, people would try and look at the broad brush causal factors, things like the relative inequality, psychosocial mm-hmm. environment, blah, blah, blah. And you could go even more extreme to the personalized view than you just did.
Yeah.
And you can say, okay, well, I want to understand the exact mechanism that is mm-hmm. causing my depression, you know, at the brain level. Mm-hmm. And that would actually be unintelligible, I would argue. So you can kind of go one step up and it can be a very personalized approach. I can go and get CBT.
Yeah.
I can understand the triggers. I can do this. I can do. And it might, you know, it might be my sleep. It might be, you know, my neurotransmitters. I might, you know, SSRIs, blah, blah. It could be a whole myriad of different things. But I can have a very personalized approach to it. Mm-hmm. And I guess like the question is, or even as a government, I could still kind of do what you said and instill the meta skill. So I can say, rather than being prescriptive, I can say you need to get some assistance and you need to uncover what
exactly.
it is for you.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's a whole spectrum here. But I guess like what we're saying is that you could still, it's not a binary, it's very complex, but you could still move the needle. And the really interesting thing about complex systems, in my opinion, is that sometimes if you do, like if you follow the gradient of the thing you want to do, mm-hmm. you cause an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, like paradoxically, you might create more depression than you cured.
Yeah, you could. I mean, more generally speaking, we just need to understand a lot better before we produce laws like this. But I totally understand what you're saying now, which is just this top-down change that you can do allows the changes to occur. Like if you think about all of this in a hierarchical nested manner, right? When you're instilling that top-down message, it allows the lower-level systems to be a little bit more malleable and learn mm-hmm. from those instructions, learn from the messages that are being passed at the high level. And so what that does is, even for us then at an individual level, when we receive that message, now that I'm aware of the things that perhaps I should improve or change or are, you know, not wrong with me, but you get dysfunctional with me perhaps,
mm-hmm.
Then I can practice some top-down exercises to help me regulate the exact thing that I have now become aware of, right? Instead of it being simply a bottom-up message, it's being counteracted by a top-down message at the same time, which is that the equal reaction thing.
Mike Levin.
Yeah.
And he is a real inspiration to me.
Yeah, to us all.
So, because he's got this beautiful, he is a biologist, I guess the clue's in the name, but this wonderful take on how life emerges gradually.
Yeah.
And I guess traditionally, people have always thought of these bright lines in evolution and biology, a bright line between us and other animals, or a bright line, you know, between different classes of intelligence, say.
Mm-hmm.
And his view is very much that it's just a continuum.
Yeah. What's the question, Tim?
Well,
am I supposed to say something there?
Let's talk about like evolution. What are your thoughts on evolution?
A do I believe in evolution?
I trust you believe in evolution.
Yeah, I do. Well, I think it's simply encapsulated by emergent properties that exist from all of these different agents existing at so many different levels, hierarchically, temporally, spatially. Some survive, some don't. It's all about resilience, sustainability. It's a beautiful process to watch, and it's a beautiful process to learn from. We know that there are some core principles that exist throughout evolution that drive it.
It's a kind of search process, mm-hmm. which accumulates information.
Yeah.
And unlike almost every other search process that we've created in computers, mm-hmm. it never converges. It's just still diverging, just continuously accumulating information and complexity.
Isn't
well,
it?
Yes. So if you look at the phylogenetic tree,
yeah.
and you look at the independent evolution of intelligences in different directions in that phylogeny, because mm-hmm. I guess now we're zooming out over time.
Well, simply that they've become more and more complex with time, right? And intelligence has existed from the get-go.
Because I believe that there are limits to intelligence.
Okay.
So even though we've seen this monotonic complexification and accumulation of information,
yeah.
Do you think we will see agents in the future that are significantly more intelligent than humans? And if we did, what would that mean?
What does it mean, more intelligent, though?
That's a good question. What do you think it means?
I think right now, when we're talking about it in this context, we are comparing to human intelligence and simply using that as a baseline. So intelligence here would be, can a certain agent just behave in the world more efficiently and more adaptively? Intelligence exists contextually depending on the organism and its abilities. So it's, you can't say whether something is more intelligent or less intelligent. It just is intelligent.
Yeah, Pei Wang has this definition, which is the adaptation efficiency given limited resources. Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. I think from an embodied point of view, you can kind of think about it in terms of efficiently exploiting your physical environment.
Mm-hmm.
There are folks who lean towards a pure form of intelligence, you know, which is talking about being able to efficiently create skill programs from limited priors and experience.
Okay.
Or being yeah. able to, you know, just from a decision theoretical point of view,
yeah.
being able to take the best trajectory of actions given limited information.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've noticed a real divide in the community between people who believe in a pure intelligence versus something which is physically situated. Like, where do you fall on that spectrum?
So what does it mean by it to be physically situated?
So I guess if you're an agent in an environment,
mm-hmm.
You can only act by doing things in that environment.
Yeah.
So in that sense, intelligence can only be viewed through the lens of things that you can physically do. Whereas another view is, I don't know, you could take Platonic forms, for example, like being able to do algebra and knowing what a circle is. And you could argue that these things are so abstract and universal that they don't bear any resemblance whatsoever to our physical world. Is the concept of an agent like a fundamental thing? Is it something we've constructed, or is it like a fundamental thing in the universe?
I think it's a way for us to understand the universe. I don't think we can ever make the argument of whether or not it truly foundationally exists or not. For us, we can believe that it does, and that's why it helps us understand the world a little bit better. But whether or not it really exists, I mean, we are all ultimately hallucinating this, right?
Yeah, so. But then, like, speaking as a psychologist, that's the interesting yeah. thing, which is that everything we know and can conceive of
mm-hmm.
is just traversing our priors, right? Our
yeah.
kind of psychological priors, which means everything we can experience or conceive of is anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
So in some sense, there's this veil or, you know, like wall that kind
yeah.
of stops us from knowing anything about physical reality.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And?
So... yeah, I guess in a way it's kind of depressing because we can only ever know ourselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this touches along umwelt. Do you know
umwelt.
The term
umwelt?
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's yeah. the word.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're kind of touching along.
Yeah.
Which is, you only ever understand the world through your perception, and it's limited by your senses. And that's it. You only know what you know. You don't know what you don't know. What Ed Yong does in one of his books called Immense World, which I've thoroughly enjoyed reading, would highly recommend it to you as well. It takes a dive into objectively, more even scientifically, explaining to us in our language that we would understand it, what the systems, the sensory systems are like of other organisms, other animals, right? So they have a different umwelt. They can see different colors. Their visual system, in terms of how many things they can focus on, to what, like what degrees, the visual field, like the area of the visual field differs along different organisms. And so we can never really imagine what they would see the world as, how they would be perceiving the world, right? You really don't know what you don't know, and you can't imagine it. You can't imagine a new color.
I know. And then I spoke with Kyle about this earlier. This is very similar to Nagel's bat, you know, which is like, what is it like to be a bat?
And a bat.
Yeah, so Thomas Nagel wrote this essay, What's It Like to Be a Bat? And he basically said that, you know, they use echolocation to get around.
Yeah,
and
but that's a description. We'll never know what echolocation actually feels like.
No,
right?
No, it's inconceivable.
Exactly.
But then you could say, well, that's phenomenology, right? So
yeah.
we can talk a lot about experience, or you can just be really no nonsense and just talk about generative models and evidence and so on. And So then you can talk about, you know, I guess it's more from a knowledge point of view or from a generative model point of view, what it's like to be a bat.
Yeah.
But so many philosophers say that it's really important to understand the experience of being a bat.
Exactly.
You know, because there is no understanding without the requisite experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where do you fall on that?
Yeah, I agree with that. It depends on why you're conducting this level of analysis, right? So if you are simply trying to understand the dynamics of it in a language that you can understand, then yeah, you can use generative models to try and understand what a bat would experience, or how it would interact, or how any other agent in the world would interact. You're using a language to describe it that you would understand. But if you're really trying to phenomenologically understand what any other organism would feel like, in all fairness, like, I don't know what it is like to be you. I can use a generative model to describe and kind of get an idea of it, but I'll never really know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the beauty of it. You have to trust that. Like, it's untouchable, right?
Yeah, it is. And I mean, this is related to John Searle's Chinese Room argument.
Yeah.
In terms of understanding, there'll always be a level of resolution which is, you know, beyond reach for a computer. Machines couldn't understand our subjective experience, assuming we have them.
Yeah.
Carl says that it's, for all intents and purposes, we don't have it, we just think we do.
Have a subjective experience.
Carl said earlier that he doesn't really believe, he thinks it's kind of like an illusion, you know, our conscious experience. But an interesting question is, do you think a machine could have a subjective experience as well as we could have one?
I agree with him that it is an illusion. And so I think we could be convinced that it does. And so ultimately, if we treat it like it does, then in our experience, it does have a subjective experience. So if for me, for whatever reason, I believe that chair has an entity and that it's sacred, and it's all about the semantics of it, right? Things mean thing, like they have meaning to humans for some reason. Such a complex thing to understand and get into and try and like understand it as well via active inference and LLMs and everything that's going on. But I can truly believe that it has an entity, and that's it. It only has to exist in my experience for that to be a reality to me.
Yeah, and I think Immanuel Kant spoke about this kind of veil of perception. But there are so many uncanny valleys. We've seen uncanny valleys with language models recently where they're so indistinguishably lifelike mm-hmm. that they may as well be real.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing what you were just saying, which is that, you know, our generative models of the world are so high resolution
yeah.
as to the point that we could basically be hallucinating. I mean, we think we are hallucinating something which actually exists.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a difference, which is to say, well, if it is just a precise simulacrum of reality, mm-hmm. then it kind of doesn't matter. But if yeah. it's different from reality, because of the uncanny valley, like you could still say in some sense it exists to you.
Yes.
But we don't want to get into any kind of kooky philosophy about idealism, or, you know, like this idea that it's almost like it doesn't matter what exists in the physical world. The only thing that exists are what exists in my mental world.
Yeah, because then we wouldn't be able to survive as a society, right? If everyone to be more delusional about the world, let's say, it results in dysfunction within the society. And I think us communicating about our shared experiences allows us to calibrate whether or not this thing actually exists. Because if you and I can both see a ghost in the room, to us, it's a reality.
It's grounded. Yeah. And I guess this is the fascinating thing that, because you know, like we were saying earlier, that it's a miracle that there is any coherence and synchronization at all.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there is the grounding of existing in the same physical space.
Yeah.
So even though, ironically, you might say everything is a hallucination.
Yeah.
Because it coalesces, we mm-hmm. synchronize, we have this inductive resonance, if you like, and
yeah.
over time it just becomes very, very close to reality. And
yeah.
the same thing happens with our language.
It does, yeah.
In a very weird distributed way. Because that's the thing, because you're sitting on that chair now mm-hmm. and you have the same conception of a chair as lots of other people because they've sat on similar chairs, maybe that chair, maybe mm-hmm. another chair, and it's all just kind of coalesced at some abstract level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, have you watched Black Mirror?
Yes.
The latest season?
No, maybe. Which one are you thinking of?
Oh, wait, no. Have you watched the one with Miley Cyrus in it?
No.
Oh, okay.
Tell us about it.
There's this this robot that is based off of Miley Cyrus as a celebrity icon.
I have seen that.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the person who owns the toy really assigns a lot of meaning to it. It has a subjective experience because she doesn't want to hurt the robot anymore, right? That exists as a reality for her. She very well knows that this is a robot. And then there's also a similar situation with Meta. I think it was last week that I came across this on Instagram, where they released some virtual agent called Billy, which is deepfaked Kendall Jenner. I don't know what her name is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. They've released about 20 bots. Like, there's a Snoop Dogg one, and
oh, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I think,
which is a bit weird, by the way.
It is incredibly weird.
Yeah.
To me, because she said that she was Billy, which was not her name. Only then do you know that it's not actually her, and so I've been given information now that this is a simulation, and so now it's my choice, according to my generative model, whether or not I want to believe that it has a subjective experience. If I don't want it to, then it won't.
When these people make these gestures and say these things in real life,
yeah.
there is a concomitant subjective experience.
There is.
And, yeah. and then, you know, what's the difference? That's the thing, like there are so many weird, you know, uncanny valleys that we're starting to experience now.
Mm-hmm.
They're teaching us about intelligence and agency and conscious experience.
Yeah.
And the remarkable thing, I don't know whether you saw that, there was a Lex Fridman with Mark Zuckerberg, and they were avatars. So they were both wearing virtual reality headsets.
Ah, okay.
And they weren't in the same physical room.
Okay.
But they believed that they were, because in virtual reality,
yeah.
there's a very high resolution generative avatar,
mm-hmm.
and they could basically almost touch each other.
Yeah.
And it was that uncanny valley. They may as well have been in the same room.
Yeah.
It was indistinguishable.
Exactly.
And Lex was saying, oh, I feel a bit weird. I feel like we're uncomfortably close.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these sensations, and you kind of know that you're wrong to feel those sensations, but you've kind of
yeah.
bridged that uncanny valley.
You just have, like that really strong prior that this is not real because I know that Mark Zuckerberg is at the other side of the world or wherever he was, right?
Yeah.
But our experiences are convincing us otherwise. And yeah. It's so real. It's so, as you say, high resolution.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is why I mentioned Luciano Floridi earlier, who was at Oxford. And yeah, his core thesis basically is that we're moving from the ontology of the physical world to mm-hmm. the information world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess 20 years ago, everything was in the physical world. You know, even like when you spoke to your postman, you went down the bank and everything like that.
Yeah.
And it's happening so slowly and perniciously. So now you do all your banking online, you do your shopping online, your relationships are online. And at some point, everything will be online. Maybe there'll be a renaissance where people will go, no, I want to live more in the physical world. But it's almost like...
I think it's already kind of happening.
Well, there's a blurring. And a lot of it is to do with this phenomenology thing, you know, which is that we always intuitively thought that there was a difference.
There was. Yeah, exactly. That is a very good point. I'm learning so much from you. Oh. Definitely. I agree with this. And I think just by studying this a lot more and kind of reproducing it via AI, it could either benefit the world or cause a lot of chaos. And we just have to be a little bit careful as to which one it does, because I think we do have enough knowledge and power to be able to guide it in a much more ethical manner that all of us can safely use all of these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was because Meta's virtual agent first gave me the information that there was a discrepancy between the name that was used and the agent that was projected to me visually. And that's how I knew that it was a deep fake. If that information was not provided to me, that would have been my reality.
In the wild, people have access to this technology and they're cloning voices. They're doing all of this stuff. And I spoke with Daniel Dennett about this. He's got this beautiful article called Counterfeit People. And, you know, he basically says we're already at the stage now where you don't know. It's indistinguishable. It's irreversible, basically. So, you know, did a human do this? Did a language model do this?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's already breaking down trust. Like when I read LinkedIn now, I mean, LinkedIn's already pretty bad to start with. It's all just language models.
Yeah.
So like, how do you think this is going to change like everything on the internet? But it's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I genuinely really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you.
Amazing. Cool.